Hey guys, welcome to episode 162 of the podcast. Of course, we are midstream. Does that make sense? Sure, it makes sense. In our Boys of Summer series, and I wanted to welcome you into this episode with the charming and extremely talented musician, Rhett Miller. I want to get some shout outs in, guys. I know I had to skip them last time. Here I go, catching up on some of it. I want to thank Andrew and two Andrews, actually. You know who you are. I want to thank Justin in Australia for your email, Kit, for your great notes and tweets about the Annie Savage episode. I want to thank Laura for letting me know that the JV Club was mentioned as a pick on the 250th episode of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. It made me so delighted. And Laura, thank you for pointing that out. A few people told me about it afterwards, but you were the first, my dear. So shout out to you. I want to thank Jacob and Jenny and Andrew and Callum for your wonderful guest suggestions. I want to thank the folks over at Damnation Land, which is a festival featuring Maine filmmakers' horror films. Very niche, guys, very niche. And I want to thank Aaron from Twitter. And I will get caught up on Facebook and more Twitter shout outs soon. I am very excited about Connecticon, the Comic-Con that I will be at this upcoming weekend. And sorry to miss the San Diego Comic-Con, but they just fell on the same date this year, and I needed to do Connecticut. It's going to be great to be on the East Coast. And then I will be in Vancouver at their Comic-Con. I guess I shouldn't say Comic-Con because that's kind of like a trademark term. But I will be at a con in Vancouver the following weekend. And then in Tampa at the end of the month, I'm going to be doing a lot of traveling. So I'll hopefully get to see you guys in person. And in the meantime, I welcome you in once again to the episode, and hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Sort of a sound check.
I mean, you're the person who I don't, because I sound checked the microphones already, and I do a.
But you don't know how loud I talk.
I do such a good impression of you. I myself podcast for 1 hour as you before I realized, oh, I'm not. That's not Rhett. That's just me.
And you might just
I have
use
a mental
that.
Illness. Yeah. You do. First of all, you're adorable for putting that pillow in your lap. I feel now like.
Well, thanks.
Just a couple of girls, Gavin. I don't know why that pillow would cross that line for me, where all of a sudden you're extra adorable, but you really are.
Thanks.
Good morning.
Good morning. I had to take my shoes off and cross my legs on your couch. It's very comfy.
Those
couch.
Are very cute socks, too.
These are, yeah, they gave them
yeah,
to me for free because I'm a rock star.
Well, one is completely different than the other, except in their color scheme.
Just hang on. Oh.
Isn't that weird? I was on
those
tour with this woman, Nikki Lane. And Nikki Lane is this amazing young rock and roll star. And she, everywhere she goes, people just give her like these amazing free clothes and stuff. So I sort of got lucky and was along for the ride one day.
No kidding. I wish I would be, it would be cool. Like first of all, I love all of you guys who are huge Korra fans, and everybody who's ever given me a present, I've absolutely loved it, with a couple of exceptions where you're like, wait a minute, what is this? I think you think I'm someone else. This has nothing to do with me. But it's never as generic. It's usually not as generic as just like, here's a great pair of socks.
Yeah.
And it would be cool if it was just like, that's the most complainy thing I've ever said about the nicest stuff in the world. It's not a complaint at all. But if someone wanted to like also give
Hook
me just
up.
Like, here's some striped socks that have nothing to do with the JV Club or Korra. But just here's some socks I thought you would like.
Well, I'll
I'd
tell
be
you.
Like, listen, I'm going to send you some socks back. Maybe I should have a sock club.
Stance socks. I'll say it right now. Stance socks. Janet Varney is a fashion icon and would rock your socks so hard.
I mean.
Tag them in this.
I could get it. I don't know what that means. Is that, that's promotion. Is that a search engine situation? Oh, God. Old lady Varney. And also, how immediately when you sat down, your stuff, took off your shoes, and already there's a guitar pick sitting on this
table. I was going to tune your 12-string guitar for you.
Oh, you pulled it out when you saw that.
Yeah. I can't look at a guitar that pretty and not just pull a guitar pick out.
What if that's all I was like, you know what? Let's just make this podcast about you tuning a 12-string guitar.
Honestly.
That'll stay interesting for 2-3 hours.
I'd love that.
You'd be fine with it.
Yeah. We were talking right before we started about the days of pre-tuners. You know, when I was 19, I dropped out of college and started my first band, and it was a 3-piece pop band, you know, pop rock band. Mm-hmm. And
What do you mean by pop rock? Like,
it's not Lana Del Rey or whatever. Right. It's like there's a band called Material Issue that was around at the same time. That was also a 3-piece pop band. And
3 pieces typically what? Guitar, bass, and drums?
3 pieces when you take the album to the woman that runs Island Records and she says, so you're really going to put a record out with no lead guitar on it?
Oh, okay. All right.
That's 3-piece.
Okay.
Although typically, like right now, there's this woman from Australia named Courtney Barnett, who is so amazing. And she plays, her band is the Courtney Barnett 3, and she does a thing not dissimilar to what Kurt Cobain did, where she plays an electric guitar. There's no real guitar solos, mm-hmm. per se, but her guitar work is interesting enough, and then the rhythm section is strong enough to where you don't miss it. Mm-hmm. And honestly, we live in a world where the solos sort of took over for a lot of the 70s, a lot of the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of prog rock and a lot of people that spend a lot of time wanking on guitar solos.
Yeah. I don't feel I need that.
No.
Because I feel we had that.
We've got enough. I mean, you know, Eddie Van Halen did it, and everybody after that is just like, okay, I'm a different version of this.
Right. So poppy. Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so I think my problem is that I can't not, like, I know that pop includes more than New Kids on the Block.
I know.
And when I look backwards, like, I'm only willing to classify bands I liked into a category that isn't pop.
Sure.
But that's not accurate. Like, Erasure's real poppy, but I would be like, it's alternative, everybody. Yeah. Or like, it's electronic. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've found my way to kind of navigate past pop because I have a negative association with it, which is absolutely ludicrous. I shouldn't.
Well, no, everybody does. It happened. At a certain point, it happened. And it was maybe right after 1990 when I did this band. But it was, for a while, pop was a thing that referenced like a really Beatles-y kind of...
Okay, see, there you go.
...kinksy thing. And you were talking more about 60s pop. And you thought of like mod styles.
Exactly.
And you know, big sort of like that Target design where there's different blue and red and white.
Yes,
and, you know, and
yes.
That's like poppy. And
okay. But yeah, that what you would associate more with what you were doing? Okay, well, there you go. Yeah. That's what I'm getting at. Because you weren't just like... I mean, you're a very handsome man, it's never been just like non-substantive.
I did it. Well, thank you. I did a TV show on VH1 the other morning with Nick Lachey.
Mm-hmm.
And and it was pretty.
How did that come to be?
Well, you know what we realized was that I was in a band. I am in a band called Old 97s, and he was in a band called 98 Degrees. So we decided we'd start a supergroup called Old 98
Perfect.
Degrees.
Perfect. Old 98 degrees. That, you know, that's when 98 degrees has gone stale. It's been in the refrigerator too long. It's been in the oven too long. Yeah. I don't know how hot or cold 98 degrees is, clearly.
Very cold.
Why were they called 98 degrees?
Because that's like the body. 98.6 is your body. You know, that's a great question. It's slightly below body temperature.
Nick Lachey, could you come in here, please? This is like the most boring This Is Your Life ever. You're like, I met him one time, Janet. Why do you have... I only have people you kind of have met once and worked with. 98 degrees, because the body is 98 degrees. That is the most clinical, uninteresting.
Well, he had great abs, though. He had such great abs. Who was the...
Why were you seeing his abs? What was he...
Well, because there was a comedian on before me, Eric... I can't remember his name. God, he's so funny, though. But he was screaming. He was really being inappropriate. And he was to the sweet girl that was interviewing him. And he was screaming, Nick, get in here. Let me see your abs. And finally, Nick slunk into the space in VH1 and lifted his shirt up. Rock hard.
Oh,
rock hard, Janet.
You know, when I was working out with a trainer whom I adore... And he now has a podcast on the Nerdist.org that he's just started, and he trained. I'm introduced him to Hardwick, and now he trains all these comedians. But he was very
And in fact, he is the trainer that Chris talks about in his Nerdist book. But he's really, he was always so great at kind of putting that stuff in perspective for me, which was basically to say, like, is that what you want your focus to be? Because if you want your focus to be rock hard abs, I'm going to take three other things that you enjoy and are important to you. Not unhealthy things, just things that you will have to give up because your focus will be constantly on your abs.
Yeah, you won't get to read books.
Yeah. You know what? I think, thank you. Thank you for that because that is not what I want to do.
Exactly.
I don't want that to be a huge focus of my life.
Well, you're looking great, Varney.
Thanks. I'm not going to show you my abs. You don't have to show me yours. That's not this kind of podcast. Nick, that's not this kind of podcast. I don't know if he heard me. Frankly, I don't know where he is or how far away he is. And well, now that I've said that, why don't you tell the listener why you're named the Old 97s?
Oh, so I'll start a little bit beforehand just to give you some idea of the influence of the person who came up with the name. Mm-hmm. When I was 15, I became friends with Murray Hammond, who is now the bass player in the Old 97s. And actually, the reason I know you originally, we met through Murray and his...
And Gray.
And... which was great. Thank God for him for that. If nothing else, for that.
If nothing, and pretty much for nothing else. What a useless waste of space Murray Hammond is.
When I was 13, I was dating a girl who was slightly older than me. She was, she and I did a little band together, and she had a friend. They were both named Jennifer. So many Jennifers. And she had a friend who was dating Murray. And so
I wish the band had been named So Many Jennifers.
So Many Jennifers. I did eventually have a song on the record I did, The Instigator, that started with the line, Jennifer One was a racehorse rider.
Uh-huh.
As if to imply there was just a long string of Jennifers after that.
Yep.
She introduced me to Murray, and Murray was my mentor for a lot of years.
And where was this taking place?
Dallas, Texas. Mm-hmm. And he lived in this little sort of band house in Lower Greenville, and I lived very close to that in the house of my family, which was sort of disintegrating at the time. You know, it was right when my dad was moving out, and I did my first gig at 15. Murray gave me my first gig when I was 15 in April of 1980.
Now, we kind of buried the lead. Red is a time traveler.
Yes.
I probably should have said that up front. But what a fun, delightful surprise for you guys to get.
Well, I do feel old, but it was 1986, in fact. And Murray gave me my first gig, and he and I were really close. He, you know, taught me everything about, you know, being in a rock band and hanging out with musicians. And I really loved it because everybody was so friendly and nice. And I mean,
Dallas had a good music scene, I guess.
Really did at the time.
Kind of still does,
huh? It was so underground. It goes up and down, like probably like most scenes. I think right now it's pretty healthy. Mm-hmm. But Dallas is the kind of place where the emphasis, you know, it's like what you're talking about. You can focus on one thing, but you lose a lot of things. Right. Dallas focuses on commerce, you know, from the outside, you'd see it as like women with big hair and men with, you know, huge bank accounts.
I mean, there was a show called Dallas that was just kind of only about that, I guess.
It was a documentary. Uh-huh. I don't know if you knew that.
You know what? I've never seen Dallas. Never.
You're not.
I listening. Know that I'm supposed to care who shot JR. But only because that was on the cover of magazines when I was a kid, and I had no. All I thought was, and this is true, because I was obsessed with I Dream of Jeannie reruns. All I said was like, "Oh my god,
somebody shot."
That's yeah,
Larry, yeah, Jeannie's husband.
Somebody shot Jeannie. Yeah, wait, what was it? Tony. Somebody shot Tony's.
The first Tony. Weren't there?
No,
two?
No, that's, that was you're Bewitched. Thinking the Bewitched. Yeah, the Darrens.
All the reruns of our youth.
Yeah. So but I love those two. I mean, I for sure wanted to be magical. So.
Oh yeah. Well, you kind of are.
Thanks.
Without
I kind of look
weird.
Like Elizabeth Montgomery.
You do look so like I've been told. Her. Does that work out well? Is that like a good look?
I mean, it's not something that like pops out of someone's face the instant they meet me. I don't think it's a negative thing, but clearly. I agree that she's not like a sex kid.
She's not. Well, you also get Nicole Kidman, right?
Yeah, and then she played her. So everything comes full circle.
So you should play Nicole Kidman playing.
They're going to do a biopic about the making of that movie no one cared about. R.I.P. Nora Ephron, I adore you, but that is not a good example of your fine work.
All right. Murray taught me how to be in a rock band. He taught me how to, you know, it was whatever, all those things. His roommate had like a three-chambered bong, and I smoked weed for the first time.
And you were only 13?
At that time, I was 15.
Okay.
And then 16 and 17. And then I really didn't do well in school, but I was doing well in music and playing gigs. And so when it came time to apply to colleges, I only applied to Bennington and Sarah Lawrence, the two freakiest, most liberal schools in America.
Isn't there a great music school in Denton?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but that's... A couple of years before, I tried to get into the high school for sort of the performing arts high school in Dallas. And I went and I brought in my guitar, my 12-string actually, and I played the songs I had written. You know, I played a song called Marching Madman about the proliferation of nuclear weapons and all this stuff. It was so stupid. Seashell Girl, which was about a girl who had seashells. Whatever. I'm not even going to go into it. It was dumb.
You know what? Side note. All this, by the way, is a podcast could be called Side Note because all it is just derailing the current conversation. But have you ever done a thing where, like, you know, some people play a set of their first song? Like, would have you? I just talked to someone who was like, I'm going to play a set of the first six songs I ever wrote or something like that. And they were like, you know, like with the idea that you're sort of shrugging and going like, well,
yeah,
but just for fun. Have you ever done that?
I've pulled out the very first song I ever wrote, but then there was like 100 after that that were unlistenable.
Okay.
So I don't really remember 2 through 99.
Right.
But the first song I ever wrote was a song about Charles Manson.
Oh,
and it was so sweet in a way. It was kind of great. It was like Charles Willis Manson. Oh boy, look what you've done. You killed the actress and the hairdresser too. Charlie, what'd they ever do to you?
Oh. God, you were like preempting Sufjan Stevens because he wrote that one song about like John Wayne Gacy that's really beautiful.
His whole career.
It sounds like a lullaby. Everything sounds like a lullaby. And you're like, this is horrible.
Yeah.
This is just about killers and death and like people being snowed in. I don't know. That may not be a thing.
So Murray was my mentor and so I applied to Bennington. This is all how the old 97s got our name. And an hour from now, I'll finally say, and that's how the old 97s got.
2 hours.
Murray was my guy and I did solo acoustic gigs and I was like a folk singer around town and in the press they would write teen folky, you know, Rhett Miller, pretty boy teen folky. I got
there
that a
you
lot.
Go.
Yeah.
Tiger Beat teen folky.
Yeah. In fact, I got around that time I got interviewed for 17 magazine and it's an interview that still sort of gets popped up. In fact, I'll try and find that.
I probably read it because I was real into 17 when I was really young because I was like, listen, I'm a grown up, so I read 17 even though I'm 12.
Of course. Well, that's. I think 17 is for 12-year-olds. It's not for 17-year-olds. And I think it was an issue that had an early Cameron Diaz on the cover as a model.
Great. Sure.
Pre-acting career.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a pretty embarrassing interview because we just started my band Sleepy Heroes with Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, well, I'll do this interview for 17 magazine.
No offense to old 97. So I'm not suggesting you change, but
boy, it was such a better name. The word old is bad marketing, apparently, it turns out.
Okay.
Yeah. Unless you finally stay a band long enough to get old and then it's like, boom, it worked out.
We did it, everybody. It was a long-term commitment.
Exactly. So, anyway, they promised me it would be a really serious interview about music for 17 magazine.
Oh, I love it.
I gave him all these great quotes about music. And then the editor called me back on the eve of publication and said, I have to ask you a couple more questions. I'm sorry. I know that you wanted to really be about music. And then she proceeded to ask me 4 questions about girls. And that was all they ran.
Of course. Of course.
And the worst
I cannot wait to see this interview. I'm so excited to find it online.
I gave one answer that I thought would be the kind of answer that would preclude the inclusion of that answer because it was so dumb.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is me and before I even understood anything about publicity.
Yeah.
You know?
Which, by the way, I feel like I, you know, just stuff comes out of me then like, oh, I guess a savvier person wouldn't have said that.
Yeah. But that's, I think that probably everyone likes that about you.
Thank you.
Your lack of savvy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Everyone's been saying that.
So the question was, she goes, what do you look for in a girl? And I said, grooviness is essential.
Oh, my God.
Grooviness is essential. And so
I'm surprised it didn't switch you to the cover with just a big quote. Grooviness is it. Rhett Miller, colon, grooviness is essential.
I still get it. People walk up after shows and say, hey, man, grooviness. I'm like, yeah, it's essential. I got it.
That's amazing. Okay, old 97.
Okay,
now
Murray was my mentor. And then I applied to Bennington and Sarah Lawrence. And even though my grades were terrible.
So you said your reason was that those were two wacky schools? Like
they didn't
progressive
give grades.
Yeah.
Brett Easton Ellis had gone to, this was in the less than zero era when he was sort of ruling the book people world. And sure. I wanted to be a writer. That was my main thing. And I thought I really like music, but this doesn't seem realistic, right? Like being a freaking novelist is realistic.
I think we all have those where we're like, you know what seems more likely? And yeah. then you list off that other career aspiration and people are like, what?
I know, like you. Why I think I'm going to go be an actor and a voiceover actor.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Good luck with that.
Yeah.
And look at you. What? By the way, I'm sitting in Janet's house right now, and it's like a mansion.
First of all, it's a 3-room house in total. If you guys view the count the bathrooms, it's 4.5.
But it's really beautiful.
Thank you. It's a little respite from Los Angeles. I guess my point is that
it's worked out pretty well for both of us. We both get to have good lives. Knock wood.
Knock wood.
Jesus. Tempting fate.
And how did you get your name Old 97s?
Okay. So that's coming.
I tried to make it as fresh of a sounding question as I could. Like, you know, it just occurred to me. I don't know how you have the name Old 97s.
I know. Well, I guess my point was I really wanted you to see what sort of influence.
That's all I want. That's Murray. All I want for the next 3.5 hours. It's true. I'm just being facetious.
I like how the time gets longer and longer. So Murray exerted a lot of influence over me. And when I was in, I went to Sarah Lawrence. Of the two, I got into both schools, okay. Not to brag.
You did get into both schools. I got into both schools. Even though you weren't a great student.
Terrible. But I had released an album, and it had been reviewed well in like Billboard magazine, and I was doing gigs. And I was good at writing. I did really well in, the school I went to was a private school, and I was doing so poorly in my junior year, and they had years before kicked out Steve Miller. And so when I was doing, I was getting Fs, and they were like, we should kick you out. This is, you know, a prestigious private school, St. Mark's School of Texas in Dallas. And, you know, Owen and Luke Wilson went there.
Oh, nice.
You know, a lot of smart people who went on and made money, and we know don't know their name. They went there also.
Yes,
and,
yes.
So they were thinking that they had to kick me out, and then finally they're like, ah, Steve Miller, whenever he comes back to do an alumni event, gouges us. Oh. So we're going to let you graduate.
Wow. So who knew Steve Miller would do you such a huge solid?
I know, right? And so my senior year, I took Shakespeare, creative writing. I only took English classes, basically, and choir. And so so I applied to these two schools that in the hopes of, you know, studying creative writing. And my now I'm the one really going off on tangents. My essay, I used the same essay for both schools. But
why wouldn't you?
Why no?
What, exactly. Are they going to talk to each other?
And it was such a crazy essay. It was, you know, the word potential follows me like the Furies. I'm sort of trying to explain away all the essay.
Oh, God, you know, this is wonderful.
My two older brothers were stillborn, and my parents half expected the same from me.
Oh, no.
Which is so gross.
I know.
I mean, who even wants to hear that? My mom was like, wow, you didn't have to tell them that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I did, Mom. I'm keeping it real.
Oh, God.
So I went to Sarah Lawrence on a full scholarship. And
scholarship.
Full, and it was the most expensive college in the country.
God damn.
I know. And my parents didn't have money, so they were like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
And so after one semester, it was a great semester. I made tons of friends, all of whom were seniors and about to graduate. And I did all this great stuff. Murray came to visit me, and he was living at the time in Rockville, Maryland, working in a cabinet shop and just like dying. You know, people say, oh, he's literally dying. He was literally dying.
Yeah.
You know, although we all are, so it's easy to say that. So
very true. Science.
He would take his crappy little bus. He had like a Volkswagen bus, and it would break down halfway, and he'd drive up and visit me. And we'd smoke pot in my, you know, dorm room. And not that I advocate that, but God, this probably contributed to this decision. And he said, just move back to Dallas, drop out of school. We're going to start a band. You don't want to do, you'll get a job. If you stay in college, you're going to just go get a stupid job. And then you're going to not ever do music. And I thought, yeah, he's right.
Uh-huh.
If I have a safety net, then I'll never, you know.
There is that. I mean, there's a combination. I'm always interested in that conversation because that was something that was thrown at me when I first moved here, or even before I moved here. That I really had a hard time with. Well, we'll get back to that because I'm interested in that concept.
But it's true. I mean, because if you, I mean, I don't know how your early career went.
I don't know. Yeah.
But I lived in squalor.
Yeah.
Abject squalor from when I dropped out of college in 19 to the time I was 29 and I started finally making money for music. I didn't break $20,000 a year. I was eating ramen noodles every night. Mm. I walked so many leases. I walked out on so many electric bills. You know, it's weird. And it was, you know, though it sounds like I'm bemoaning it, it was amazing. Those years were incredible.
Well, no, I think that's, I mean, I guess maybe I'm romanticizing it enough that I don't think of it as complaining or that I don't, because I mean, I do agree. I'm not saying that for everyone, everything is always true, and that like you can't have a safety net or you won't pursue your passion, or that the opposite is true. But certainly I agree with you that like once you get comfortable, it's hard to get uncomfortable. And so if you have a thing that is really hard to succeed at, and you don't do something else, that's like, well, I do have this other job that affords me these things. It starts to kind of like, you know, put a little bit of a grimy face on something that is like something you really should be pursuing. So I get it.
Yeah. But it's that thing. It's like if somebody's meant to do it, they'll do it, you know, right, regardless of what anybody says. And I feel like I was meant to do music. I missed out on some pretty amazing opportunities at Sarah Lawrence. There's some great teachers there. And now I always said in my 40s, I'm going to start pursuing fiction seriously, because at that point, whatever will have happened with music will have happened. And mm-hmm. so I am really starting to write more and more these days. And now it's like, I wish I could just go back to Sarah Lawrence now. Like, how creepy would I be, like the 40-something-year-old guy?
Hey, guys.
Hey, you know, it's one of the reasons I picked it as a college was because it was like 75% female.
Uh-huh. Well, awesome. I mean, it's in the name.
It's a
numbers
game.
It's a girl's name.
Yeah. So Marie came up and convinced me to drop out of school, and I did. And we came.
Do you guys have you had a conversation? I'm sure you've had multiple conversations since. Has he ever been like, I mean, I do feel kind of guilty about.
Oh, hell no.
A beautiful Southern accent.
No, it was me. I did it.
Okay, I got it.
You know, I hate school.
Loud and proud.
Murray is he's a punk rocker. That's where his heart was, and now he seems like a, you know, a hayseed or whatever.
Oh no, me doing his accent is not. I don't mean to suggest that, but he does have like.
Pretty much the
greatest. You guys are very, I mean, it makes sense to me that you guys are friends because certainly what you have in you is straight up rock and roll. And like, you know, I totally believe and appreciate the punk rock aspect, but you are living proof in the same way Rob Zombie is of you can't make assumptions about someone's core personality based on like an edginess or a recklessness or a fuck you-ness that they bring to their art necessarily
yeah.
because you guys are like, some of my favorite people. Like, you're funny and warm, and there's like a gentleness to you in this, but there's also, you know, you could be an asshole if you want, you know what I mean? But like, that's just, I mean, and also I met Murray as Tex's dad.
Yeah.
So like, it's the first time I ever really met him and saw him. He was just like, you know, engaging with this amazing little boy. And
yeah, he's really, really sweet. And he always has been.
What a great hayseed.
I know. He talks, you know, he's from outside Fort Worth. When someone says, well, I'm from a little bit outside Fort Worth. You're like, wow, that's, that's pretty far in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
But yeah, he's a sweet dude.
On him, that accent works like a charm.
Oh, it really does. It's so, and it's funny. I moved to LA before he did. And I was, you know, pursuing a girl, a Dallas girl that lived out here and did, producing in movies and was really cool. And I was really glad that she sort of gave me a reason to move out of Dallas and to move to LA. And the friends I've made here and like kind of the connections through that Largo scene. I just have really loved LA over the years, but Murray gave me such grief about it when I first moved mm-hmm. here. You're turning into somebody I don't even know.
Oh,
okay. Now he lives in Pasadena.
That's right.
You know,
that's right. But you don't have an accent. Did you?
I should.
A lot of people in Dallas I know don't.
I'm a seventh generation Texan. And
did you have one? And do you remember getting rid of it? Or like, did you notice that it just kind of got rid of it?
I think when I was a little kid, I did a little bit, but I was such an Anglophile from such an early age.
Mm-hmm.
My the record I made in high school is embarrassingly British. Like, you know, Seashell Girl keeps fire and so
on. Oh, you almost actually have a British accent.
Happy. Yeah.
Wonderful.
That was, it was, yeah. That's why I've tried to keep it from being re-released, that record.
I like what I'm hearing based on just some, the description and what I just heard come out of your mouth.
So really the way good. The old 97s got our name was that Murray had convinced me to drop out of college and I moved back to Dallas and we started bands that we thought might get signed. Cause at the time, and this is crazy cause I think it's different now, at the time, the end all be all goal of a young musician was to sign a contract with a record label,
yeah.
which is so weird because it's such a lopsided contract. That's not good for the musician, but it was such a validation at the time.
Sure.
And it offered such opportunities for sort of winning the lottery, because maybe you get to be the band that has a hit song. Oh, right. You get to be the Gin Blossoms or whatever it was in the 90s.
You know what I think is interesting about this? Because I won't ever let you say how you got the name ever, is that just the idea of making the decision to do something that feels like a lottery in a lot of ways, but everything you described, you know, just living in squalor and not bringing money in and having to eat ramen and all that kind of stuff, that somehow I would imagine pushing it all the way to the furthest degree, which is like, and I don't want to be signed because I don't believe in da 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 da. So it's an interesting combination of sort of, like, you know, we wanted to have this commercial success, so we were doing bands that we hoped would have that, opposed to, but you were still following your passion, opposed to, you know, we didn't care if we were going to get signed, we were just going to play the music we wanted to play. Or, well, you know, I was working at Williams-Sonoma, but I wanted a band, so we tried to come up with a band that would get signed. You know what I'm saying? Like, you can sort of see how either extreme could be true, and yet you were doing a half and half almost. Does that make sense?
Well, you're right. It's like there are maybe three paths. There's the path where you eschew all hopes, or at least outwardly professed hopes, of monetary success or, you know, whatever. And then there's also the path where you say, I don't have any money and I can't do this forever unless I make some money. So I want to do something that people are going to like.
Yeah.
But to your point, that's a dangerous path, because trying to calculate what people are going to like.
Because that happens here. That's why it stuck out to me so much. Because that's, we all go through that, where it's like, well, I'm not making any money. I guess I should start going and doing dog food commercials if I can. Or I want to write something that a network will want, which doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to love it, but they'll love it, and then I'll have money. Do you know what I mean?
Like, and
that
I'll
stuff still exists
want.
Very much as adults in any creative capacity. I think we all sort of come to that point of reckoning over and over again, or just once, or you know what I mean?
And it's tough though, because it's sort of at what cost? I mean,
absolutely.
Because if your plan works and they do like that, are they really going to let you do the other thing that you really wanted to do the whole time?
Right.
So we spent about 4 years from the time I dropped out of college till the time I was 23 doing these different bands that, you know, it was just right before Nirvana was breaking. And that was, you know, we were doing these rock bands.
How many people would be in the bands besides the two?
We did the three-piece Sleepy Heroes. And then we did a four-piece that my friend Joe played guitar, and he came from LA and he came from a metal background. And so we were shredding, and he was a lot of great. You know, it was like, you know, it was a very kind of Nirvana sounding thing. I was playing a distorted rhythm guitar, and it was a big loud rhythm section, and then some shreddy kind of guitar happening, and it was pretty fun, you know, but it never felt terribly natural. And when we did the songs that really felt natural to me, you know, there were critics in Dallas that would write about it at the time. And of course, I remember to this day the harsh criticism that we'd get. Oh, another mid-tempo rocker from Rhett Miller's new Sludge Fest or whatever.
And
it was so frustrating.
Oh, no.
And it wasn't working. It wasn't, the calculation was misfiring. You know, there wasn't, you know, we would have A&R guys come out and they'd be like, it's pretty good. You know, some of the songs are pretty good. And it would trail off, you know?
Yeah.
And then finally, we got so frustrated.
Feel like it was, I hate to use this word, but yet I feel I need to use this word. Do you feel like it was lacking authenticity?
Well, yeah. I think in a way, there were kernels of something very real in it, because we were doing it. And I don't think any of us could have done it if it didn't have something in it that was of us.
Sure.
But we were processing it through something that we thought people wanted to hear.
Yeah, there you go.
And so it was, I remember it was right around when Nirvana was on Saturday Night Live. And I remember watching that and going, okay, this is it. You know, they've done it, and they've done it well, and I'm never going to be able to do that like what they did. And they already did it, and it's already done. And so whenever you see the zeitgeist really crashing through, you know that it's over, you know, because it was probably over before that.
And I'm not a huge Nirvana fan, and I know that's like a sacrilege to say.
Sorry.
I certainly appreciate them, but like my friends who were obsessed with them when I was still listening to Talking Heads and stuff, you know, it was just like, that's not for me or whatever, you know, I was still whatever music I was into. And then I was kind of into like The Cure and stuff. But I think I was, whatever was happening when Nirvana were breaking. I mean, I liked Pearl Jam, same, but like all of that stuff, I was like, oh, I get it. Everyone loves this. And yeah. I think I had a little bit of that sort of like, but so I'm not going to. But also it felt like, oh, he doesn't know how to be anything but that. Like,
yeah.
That's exactly who he is, for better or for worse. And if you look at that and you're like, oh, he is that.
Yeah.
Am I that? Like, can exactly. I not be anything else? And if you're asking, even asking the question,
then,
yeah. am I not that? Yeah. Then you're not that.
And it's funny because I'm like you. I liked Nirvana because at what they did, they were exceptional. But I didn't like all that stuff. I didn't like Pearl Jam. I didn't like all that. And I realized, like, oh my God, I'm kind of doing something I don't like. So Murray and I both just shut it down. Mm. And we took like 6 months of no music. And it was a really, really weird soul-searching time mm-hmm. because I'd thrown everything away to do this. And then Murray came to me one night. We were both listening to old-timey country music exclusively, you know, like Hank Williams Sr. and Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys and this old obscure rockabilly stuff. And it was as if the whole kind of culture had gotten away from us. And it was going to this kind of angry, loud place. And we had gone along for a little while. And then we realized, oh my God, this doesn't feel right. It doesn't
yeah.
feel right.
Yeah.
And so we said, and this is the conversation that led to the conversation where we got our band name. We sat in this room in this little squalid apartment in Dallas next door to where the first case of Ebola broke out last
Yay,
year.
Hey, humble brag.
I know. we sat there and said, let's do a band that doesn't really stand a chance of getting signed, that nobody's going
to
like.
That.
And so this was the third path. I said there's three paths. There's the you can give the middle finger to the whole world and say, I don't want your money. You know, take your money and throw it in the ocean. I don't,
right.
I hate you all.
Right.
Which I always feel like is a little bit of like fear of success.
I was going to say, I don't know. It's hard to know who actually yeah. feels that and who is afraid.
Because if you say that, and then you can always say, well, I told him I didn't want it. Right. So I had no success because I told him I didn't want it.
Sure.
So, and then there's the people that calculate, and I think that rarely works, although, you know, they're the 98 degrees of the world that are Svengalied and forced down the throat of the public. And
But maybe those people, honestly, that's what they make, because that's another conversation.
Right.
It's like people are like, I'm going to use Adam Sandler. It's a bad example, but I think I've used it before because obviously his movies don't do as amazing or aren't as applauded, you know, as maybe they once were. But like somebody like that, or somebody who's just straight ahead, who somehow captures the love of so many people, and that I myself might say, and he's the nicest guy in the world, but I myself might be like, God, it feels like he's dumbing down, or it feels like he's pandering or whatever. And then it's like, you know what? That might just be what he knows how to do and what he thinks is funny. And it might not feel like he's, you know, 98 degrees might be like, this is our music.
Exactly.
This is exactly what our music is.
Yeah.
You know, this is all I know how to do. Or they might not, but you know,
if Adam Sandler was, I don't know, Marc Maron or somebody whose sensibilities were way more cynical, and he decided like, hey, you know what? I'm going to make a lot of money if I have a 45-second long fart
right.
or whatever.
Right.
And then that's what he did. I think that people would sense not only the inauthenticity, but the fact that it was a really manipulative, disingenuous
yeah.
maneuver to get their money
yeah.
by playing off of how stupid he perceives them to
yeah.
be.
And the timing is so much of it, too. It's like you might, you know, for everything that had, it sounds to me like everything had to happen the way it did for you guys to arrive at the place that you arrived, which was like, we've done this, we've done this, we've done this. Then we had to just put all that away. And then, you know, maybe if you had come to Old 97s, thank God we still don't know why you're named that. If you would come to that from the very beginning, maybe also at that point, people would have been like, we don't want that.
Exactly. And I wouldn't have been ready for it either, because I wouldn't probably appreciate that something that was that weird and at the time that unpopular of a sound. You know, I probably in the back of my mind, I would have always been like, oh man, why can't we be doing like Nirvana's doing or whatever?
Yeah.
Guess what? I tried that and it was horrible for me. And so we made this band that was like, you know, we just wanted to play in coffee shops. We just wanted to play the kind of music that we liked. And if nobody ever liked it, we figured we'd at least get girlfriends out of it. You know?
It always comes back to the ladies.
Of course, man. That's what keeps the world repopulating. So we were trying to figure out what we would call the band. And we'd had so many band names over the years. Rhett's Exploding being the most egregious example of just,
I feel like I remember you telling me about that one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
But we, you know, some of them weren't so bad. We had, you know, the Sleepy Heroes, I felt like was a pretty good band name.
Yeah, it's great.
One of those proto pre-grunge bands was called Buzz. I mean, is there a more proto grunge name than Buzz?
Yeah, it really is. It's like you fed it into a computer and it spit back out the name for you.
So we had gone through so many namings of bands and so many late night, you know, conversations about what does it mean and what, who's going to like it. And so when it came to this one, and the whole idea was that we wanted to be ornery in a way. We wanted to just be what we wanted to be. And we didn't want to be popular. And we wanted it to be sort of obvious from when people heard our name that we weren't trying to be popular.
Yeah.
And so we had a few, and it's just so hard to not be hayseed in that, in this kind of world, to not be, oh, the railroad friends, you know, or whatever.
That's great.
That's actually a go-to whenever we play with an opening band that's sort of really kind of doing the hee-haw shtick.
Yeah.
Like, who's opening? Oh, Railroad Friends. So Murray came to me and he said, I have an idea. You know, the Johnny Cash song, "Old Wreck of the Old 97. What if we were just called Old 97s? And I, of course, you know, pointed out the bad marketing, you know, value of the word old. And he said, well, no, but it's like the 101ers, which was Joe Strummer's first band before The Clash. Mm-hmm. And that sort of sealed it for me. I'm like, well, shoot, that does kind of sound like something Joe Strummer would do.
Right.
And so that's how the Old 97s got our
name. I got to tell you, too, I mean, for all of our quipping about the nature of that naming and what you think is not a good marketing tool, I think that I... It's hard to say because once you know something, then you don't know like which came first. Like, did I know what kind of music it was before I knew the name? You know what I'm saying? Like, did I immediately become acquainted with the music and the name at the same time? I would say I don't think I did. And I think based only on the name, I was exactly right about the music. So I think you did your job because I there was nothing else it would be in my head.
Yeah. I mean, because it does sound like, it sounds like it's a reference to something kind of old timey, but then it's got like a mysterious aspect to it because like, what is an old 97? And think, you know, when we named the band this, it was 1994.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of the year 1997 was one of those things that was just looming out in the distance.
Right, right.
And I thought, well, God, there's no way we're going to make it to that year anyway. So
do people now... Like, do young people who have no sense of anything think that it is a reference to 1997?
Some people
that come up
get confused and write it as Olds 97, thinking it's a reference to a 1997 Oldsmobile.
Oh, God.
But whatever. It's still funny. You know, at least it's got a mysterious aspect to it. You know, it's not something that's just super obvious.
Right.
You
know? Now, let me go back to this private school that you went to in Dallas, St. Mark's of Dallas.
St. Mark's School of Texas, all-boys private school.
Okay, so it was an all-boys school.
It was connected to Hockaday, which is an all-girls school.
That's a terrible...
Hockaday, they were sister schools. And my grandmother had gone to Hockaday, and she was credited a million years ago with as a newspaper writer for the Hockaday newspaper, coining the term Hockadaisies.
I appreciate that. Any made up put together of two words into one word, I can get on board for if I like it, if it's punny enough.
Oh, and there's still Hockadaisies to this day. We'll all see. The little girls at Hockaday. Yeah.
Look at that legacy.
That's pretty cool.
And so what were your friends? I mean, if you weren't doing particularly well, was it just sort of a general impatience and like dreamer quality that you had that was just like, I don't get why this is important or...
Yeah, it was a weird thing. Cause
and you said your family was a little bit on the rocks. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger brother and a younger sister whom I love very much. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be on vacation with them next week. So we're still super close. And their kids are so great. And our kids all love each other. I feel really lucky because you see a lot of families that splinter pretty quickly.
Sure.
Especially when there's sort of a broken home element, you know. And it was tough when we were growing up. My dad has come a long way. There was a time when he just kind of wasn't around a lot. He worked a lot, and by the time I was 17, it had been quite a few years since he had really been home consistently. And that was when he moved out, and my folks got divorced. And my sister was 12 at the time, and it was really tough. And those years leading up to it were really tough. But
did you almost wish that it had happened sooner in the sense that it kind of already was happening?
Were you the kind of kid like me that like you'd look at older kids that had braces and go like, God, I wish I had braces.
Yeah, I think I mean, I had braces. I guess I had braces when I was in sixth grade. So I got them pretty fast.
I wanted
braces. But I do feel like I wanted braces. I wanted glasses.
Well, did
my parents split when I was very young, so that was already taken care of.
Yeah. Well, see, I looked at kids with braces and with broken homes like you, and I was like, I wish my parents would get a divorce. It just seems so cool, you know, two houses, two, you know, whatever, like an idiot. I'm thinking like, oh, that'd be great.
And but I also think that there has to be some foundation for, like, I don't think you would think that if your parents had a great marriage. Exactly. That's something that occurs to someone who's like, I mean, things aren't great as they are, so might as well have two houses.
Yeah, and I remember at the time, the appeal to me seemed all about, like, the logistics of it. But I think it was, I was sensing the beginnings of what would eventually sort of, you know, end their marriage. But And they're both really happy now. They've both remarried and they've got really good lives. I've got good relationships with both of them. But yeah, at the time it was super hard. And I wasn't easy. You know, I had a lot of issues as a kid. I was the oldest and I, in fourth grade, I got this really weird inner ear imbalance that had me in the hospital for like 3 months where I couldn't walk without falling down.
Oh, and God. I've definitely, because I used to have tonsillitis all the time and I would have lots of ear infections, and that still to this day, like any inner ear thing where I start to feel like woozy or wobbly or foggy.
It's weird, right?
No, thank you.
Because it's so mysterious and it's not like something that you can just go, oh, this is what it is.
It's like vertigo, kind of.
Yeah. And my thing was kind of undiagnosed or undiagnosable for a long time. I mean, towards the end of it, I'd been in the hospital for like months. And my folks would kind of come spend the night some. And then eventually they're like, we got to go on with our lives. And, you know,
and what age was this?
Fourth grade. I was the age my son is now, fourth, fifth grade. Yeah. And,
oh, that is rough.
It was weird, but you know, whatever. It's the things that you go through make you who you are. And and I survived it. And at the end of it, I remember they sent me up to Syracuse, New York, and my dad and I flew up there. And there was a panel of specialists seated at a horseshoe-shaped table.
Oh, my.
And my dad rolled me in a wheelchair. And they said, can you walk for us? And I was like, well, I can't, you know, really walk. And they said, well, can you crawl for us? And I said, oh, okay. And so I crawled in circles on the floor. And I just remember the shoes of these, you know, patent leather loafers and tassel loafers and these doctor's shoes. And I remember thinking like, oh my God, I have to get better. This is so lame.
Oh God, no kidding.
And it was really tough on my parents. And my dad had broken his back not long before and he'd had his own whole thing. So there's just a lot that went on. And then the year after that, it was a public school that I went to, and in a pretty, you know, my grandparents had some money, and so we were still on the outskirts of the nice part of town. So we were in this, Highland Park is the school system in Dallas that's really wealthy, you know, and Jordan Spieth came from Highland Park, the golfer now that's dominating. I think he's Highland Park. Anyway, it's a rich kid school, and we were not rich, which was its own sort of weirdness. And I didn't have any friends. All I did was read books. And I got beat up for not having a maid. I got beat up for reading books. I got called opera singer because I had the solo in the fourth grade school pageant, you know, play. Yeah. And it was just not fun. I felt like the emphasis at this school and in this community, in this sort of wealthy community, was one that I couldn't live with. Mm-hmm. And so I researched schools and I found Simon's Rock of Bard College up by where I live now in Poughkeepsie. I live right across the river from that in New Paltz. Simon's Rock is this really cool, smart school that's like that bleeds into college where your last year or two are college credit years. And I found that. And then I found St. Mark's School of Texas, which was the best school in the Southwest, you know, and it had the highest matriculation rates to the best colleges.
Oh, that's convenient.
Yeah. And you know, as a fourth grader, I was reading Catcher in the Rye. I was reading these, and I remember when I went into interview for St. Mark's, they said, what's the most recent book you read? And I said, well, I just finished Catcher in the Rye, and I really liked it a lot, you know. And I talked about his relationship with Phoebe, his little sister, and they were just looking at me like, who told you you could read Catcher in the Rye?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, my mom told me, you know.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about this the other day. My son is that age now. He just finished fifth grade. But Easter of this year, I gave him a book that I had really liked. And it was not as much literature as Catcher in the Rye is. In fact, it's being made into a movie with Matt Damon. It's called The Martian.
But oh, okay.
It's a really smart book. But there's four F-bombs in the first paragraph. And, and that was in his Easter basket. And all his cousins, and they're all looking at their Easter baskets. And he pulls out, and he's like, oh, cool, a book. And he opens it up. He's like, ooh, maybe I'll share this one with the churchgoers.
That's hilarious.
But so I went to St. Mark's and really loved it. And it was sort of that be careful what you wish for, because the first couple of years I really felt finally like I fit in. And then I...
Were there a lot of other creative young men and like...
No, but there was a lot of other readers and a lot of other... there's a lot of smart kids. There were a lot of kids that it was more important to them to be intelligent than to be cool or even athletic. And so I tried to stick with the athletics, and I was on the football team in 8th and 9th grade and on the basketball team in 8th grade. And I really loved it. But at a certain point, you know, adolescence really, I think especially with boys, and it hits later than with girls. And when it hits with boys, it's just so violent, literally violent. Mm-hmm. And I remember trying out for the football team in 9th grade, and suddenly everybody was bigger and there were mustaches and their voices sounded like this. And I was already starting to play music and, you know, grow my hair out a little bit.
And if you were an Anglophile, that's not exactly, you know what I mean? It's like when I wasn't listening to The Who, thinking about The Who, like in basketball shorts and high socks, you know?
No, you're like a rock and roller.
Yeah. And so, like, their sport is scooters.
Yeah. And so these kids would line up across from me in the line and they'd, you know, encourage me to quit the football team. I'll put it that way. And finally I was like, yeah, okay, I will. I'll quit the football team. And so I decided that rock and roll was more my bag, and I started doing, you know, gigs when I was 15. And then so to your question about why did I get F's, it was because I was doing gigs the night before, and I'd come in biology at 9 a.m., which is something that I didn't even want to know about anyway. Yeah. I'm like, I think flowers are beautiful. If you start explaining to me why they're beautiful, I'm going to go to sleep.
Right, right.
So I failed.
Yeah, why did that? I feel like when I look back, all of the classes that were the most detrimental for me to have in the morning, I had in the morning.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really remembering that now. Like, I remember having geometry in the morning, pre-algebra in the morning, biology in the morning. Like, why couldn't I have had English in the morning? That never happened. I never had like a creative thing I was good at in the morning, except maybe French. I think I had French as my first period one year.
Oui, bien sûr.
Bon matin, tu sais. But yeah, it's funny. It's funny because that makes it even harder. Like, I hated getting up in the morning. I was out of it.
Yeah.
And then to try to focus on something that requires the most concentration.
Do you think other kids did that thing where they like wake up and they're like, oh, first thing in the morning is when I feel most alive or whatever? Or were we just weird?
I don't know, because I never thought of myself as a morning person. And a lot of the time, like, I mean, I feel bad saying this now because my dad's a high school teacher, but I would fake sick and stuff and then suddenly start feeling better around 3rd or 4th period. Like, I would want to take the morning off of school. And I just, you know, but then also, like, I was a kid who had sort of that ADD thing where, like, I was really hyper in the morning.
No way.
All the way
were?
Up through, all the way, but like not in a focused way. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, not like I didn't want to get up. I remember waking up, especially in the winter when you had to wake up and go to school, and waking up and having a sinking feeling as if someone had died.
Oh, do you remember Sundays?
Depression.
And how bad Sundays, like Sunday
God,
evening?
Knowing you had to go back to school on Monday.
Oh, it was the dread. Oh,
the end of summer. The end of summer still is like this wild, lonely, desperate feeling of like, I don't want to get a new trapper keeper. That's not going to make me feel better about going back to school.
And I know, they'll probably listen to this and I'll get in trouble. I think my son is going to be pretty good about that because he deals with stuff better than I ever did. But I really see my daughter dealing with things a lot of the same way I do. And I feel for her. It almost, it just makes me want to weep when I think about it.
Does she go to public school or does she go to?
We live in a really great public school area.
I mean, I went to public school because this is what I was going to say, and this is a horrible thing to say. But I do think that some. As a person who went to public school, these guys know I like talking about public school versus private school, maybe too much. But as a person who went to a co-ed school is the more important thing.
Yeah.
I've talked to people who are like, thank God I didn't go to a co-ed school. I've talked to people who are like, thank God I did. I feel like having crushes on people, gay or straight, like, I mean, if you're going to a private school and it's one gender and you're gay, lucky you, or you're bi, lucky you. Because I feel like a lot of the time what took me into school was like I had a crush on someone.
Oh, that's funny.
I mean, I'm not even kidding. Like, I think to myself, like, what would my relationship to school have been if I didn't have that sort of sexual electricity when I was in high school? And I don't know what the answer to that is. I honestly don't know.
You're making me wonder something I've never wondered. I've always dated women who were a little bit older than me, you know, like a year, 3 years, whatever.
Because you didn't associate school with sex.
But you know what? The crushes I had were on my French teacher, were on the woman that worked in the library.
Sure.
So I did have crushes, but they were on older women.
Yeah. Oh my God, so how much does that dictate, like, where your interest is, and how does that stuff inform, like, the rest of your life and all that kind of stuff?
Those,
so interesting.
Those years are so formative. Oh,
yeah.
I mean, I've tried normally not to talk about my kids in press stuff just because I feel like, A, they didn't ask to be dragged into it.
Sure.
And B, it's not that becoming for a rock and roller because I'm on stage like swiveling my hips and thrusting my pelvis. You know, you don't want to think about, like, oh, he's also a dad.
Right.
But I do feel like it speaks so much to what you do with this podcast that to think about sort of what, for instance, my son is on the brink of. And I just recently had to have the talk with him about masturbation. And it's such a funny thing because I really want to take all the shame out of it for him.
Yeah.
Because, oh my God, it's just so stupid the way kids get messed up with, I mean, not just obviously, you know, with sex in general. But even with that, I just want him to know, like, hey, it's okay.
Yeah.
Poor Max. I'm talking about it. Oh. But, and I'm sure he never will.
Yeah, no. I'm sure he won't. I'm sure he never has, never will. No, but that's, I wonder if this is, I feel like I've said this before, but I can't remember if it's on a podcast or in life. But I'm so interested, like, as we, don't you wonder how, as we evolve as a culture and the way we raise our kids and we remove some of these stigmas and we remove the shame about a lot of different stuff, makes me wonder what people's sexual proclivities are going to be. Like, will there always be fringe stuff? And I mean, there always will, because things will always happen differently for everyone. But if you start stripping away some of that stuff, it just makes me wonder, like, what people's, like, fetishes are going to be. Do you know what I mean? I just wonder, because I think some of that stuff is born out of, like, well, you should be ashamed of this, or you saw this happen, you felt weird about it, but then you also felt sexy about it, and then you kind of went down that road for that reason. And do you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, where, like, the thrill that you feel is inextricably connected to whatever the bad thing was or whatever. Yeah. I wonder if, as things are, like, are we becoming more open-minded and more accepting, or are we not?
We're becoming more puritanical about everything.
Yeah, that's sort of what it seems like. Yeah. I mean, you think of Europe as being a lot more open and accepting. You know, you think of the 60s as being a time when, you know, it was a lot more free love and a lot less, you know, judgmental and just shitty to people about, so what? So somebody likes that. Who cares?
Right.
Like, aren't there bigger, more horrible things in the world? And who wants to pork who?
Yeah.
Ma.
Thank you. Thank you for classing up who wants to pork whom. Oh, wow. Oh, God. That's maybe the best thing that's ever been said. That's beautiful. Yeah, I know. I agree. But I do. But then at the same time, you feel like socially, it's becoming, like, there's so much that's coming to the forefront of, you know, gay rights and trans rights and all that kind of stuff. But there is still sort of, it, the whole gay marriage thing, it, like, kind of goes down the road of, like, if we parallel this quote unquote behavior, which of course I don't believe is a behavior, it is how you're born. But if we equate this to something that feels safe and family values-y, will then become more integrated into the main culture. And that's hard to do with, like, certain sexual practices that still don't align with marriage and don't align with, you know, like polyamory.
Well, and you hear
like stuff like that, where that's still fringe because it's like, well,
yeah,
you still need to love one person.
I know, that's so weird. I wonder if that's really the next big area where we'll see change, is more acceptance of
non-monogamy or
Well, I think you're already seeing that. I think so many people are living alone, and so many people are eschewing the trappings of, you know, oh, you got to get married, you got to have kids by this age,
absolutely,
you got to do this. And dude, we live in a world where we really don't need any more kids, you know. And so everybody I see, like, I really love Jen Kirkman's you know, book, and her, you know, her whole gestalt about this thing about, don't pressure me to have kids, because A, I don't want to, and B, I'm doing fine without them, and C, the world doesn't need any more freaking kids.
Yeah.
We can't even, I mean, we're growing at such an exponential rate as a culture. Yeah, it's, we can't, we're not going to be able to live on the earth. Anyway, so I wonder if that's coming, because I do think that we're all living so long, and, you know, having watched my parents find a love eventually later on with somebody else. You know, it's what it is. You know, yeah. I think that to vilify and stigmatize, you know, the sine wave that is love, you know, to say, hey, you can be in love with somebody and then out of love with somebody and then, you know, whatever. Just if anybody's in love at all with anybody, we're all so lucky.
That's so great. Just no, that's celebrate a great point. It. Who cares who's wants to pork whom? I can't believe this. It's been almost an hour. I cannot even started this MASH game, but I do play a MASH game on the podcast, which I typically try to marry to certain things we've talked about in the podcast. And I'll also add things that I know about you outside of this, because I am fortunate enough to have a friendship with you that extends past this podcast. So do you know MASH? Do you know how to play MASH? Mansion, apartment, shack, and house?
By the way,
shout out to Orange is the New Black. In my fantasy, someone listens to my podcast who writes for that show because they just introduced that in this latest season. Ooh. There's an episode where they play MASH, and I'm like, I'm the only other person I know who's still talking about MASH as an adult, you guys.
I bet you're right. I mean, right?
That's my fantasy.
You're pretty beloved. I don't want anyone to tell me otherwise.
I want to believe that that's the case.
Well, I haven't played it since I was a kid.
Yeah. It's only gotten better.
Okay.
In my version. The first one is going to be, let's get this out of the way right away, three musicians, bands, singer-songwriters, someone that it's likely you won't have the chance to perform with for one reason or another. Death is probably a big one.
Yeah.
That it would have been great to share the stage with.
Well, David Bowie's always been my number one
love it
idol. And I've had people that recommend that I should write to him and write him a letter and reach out, and maybe he'd want to write songs and I'm so terrified of it. You know, he means so much to me that I don't know if I can give up the relationship we already have.
Yeah.
You know?
It would be cool if, I mean, yeah, I completely and totally get that. And I always say that I want to meet someone like on some sort of equal footing, to where like you would meet him backstage at a show and he would say to you, I love your music. And then you would be like, well, listen, you know, opposed to like, Mr. Bowie, hi.
Exactly.
My name is Red. You know.
Well, Elvis Costello was always that for me. In fact, when I lived in L.A. Years ago, I ran into him at Book Soup, literally, where we were going around a corner and I ran into him and I knocked all the books out of his hands.
Oh, that's gorgeous. What a great meet cute.
I know. Cinema. And I'm wearing my Elvis Costello glasses.
Oh, that's great.
And I've probably written three songs that week that straight ripped off his entire oeuvre, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I look at him and I think to myself exactly what you just said. I think, I'm not going to do it. If I ever get to meet him, it's going to be because we are sharing a bill.
Right.
We're introduced by mutual friends.
Yes.
And eventually it happened. And
we
had dinner at Nobu next to each other.
Oh, that's great.
And he talked, you know, it was so funny. He talked shit about this guy outside of the venue that we had just left. He goes, oh, he was wearing the straight up this year's model outfit. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm so glad I didn't talk to him, because when I ran into him, I was there.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, that's perfect. Okay, David Bowie, give me two more.
Joan Jett. I think I could theoretically meet her. She's around and still killing it.
Yeah.
But when I was, you know, I'd come out of the hospital. Do you want me to just give you the answer and not explain it?
No, I like the explanation. That's a big part of it for me.
When I'd come out of the hospital with that weird illness, the whole summer afterwards, I had to walk around using those crutches that go around your wrists.
Oh, yeah.
Like the little tiny Tim crutches. And so somebody at Pace Concerts in Dallas knew my mom, and somehow I got tickets to see the Texas Jam that year, which was the big outdoor concert. And I was a little kid and I'm a million years old. So it was like Sammy Hagar and Journey and Joan Jett. And when I'd been in the hospital, my parents had brought in a little record player and I had played my three Joan Jett and Runaways albums on a loop. Oh. And I was so in love with Joan Jett. And at the time I was in fourth grade. I didn't really know that she maybe even didn't like boys, you know, like that. But, and I didn't even know that I liked, I just loved her. I just loved her so much. I loved her attitude, her strength. It was something that I couldn't, and I've never had, you know, to this day, I've done countless hours of therapy trying to be able to stand up and say, I don't give a damn. You know, I'm always apologizing and, oh, I hope you're okay. What can I do to make you happy?
Yeah.
And so it's just not, I wanted to be what she is.
And so I wanted to meet her. And so the Texas Jam people brought me backstage.
Oh, God. This is the best.
And I had my little crutches on, and I had an 8x10 and a Sharpie in one hand clutched to the little handle of the crutch. And they said, okay, well, Joan Jett is going to be coming from her trailer to the stage in a minute. And so we're not going to have very long. We'll just stand right here. And as she walks past, we're hoping that we're going to get a moment with her. And so she was surrounded by her band, but I forced my way into this crowd because she's little and they were all big. And so I kind of pushed my way so that as they walked past, she walked right by me. And in the moment where I could have said, "You're my hero, can I get your autograph?" All I could think to say was, "Are you Joan Jett?"
Oh!
And she said, "Yeah," and kept walking. I wanted so bad to hug her or tell her I loved her.
Well, you got to write a book about yourself. It's a really good story.
Little Joan. And I thought maybe I'd meet her someday. And I just have never gotten to meet her. But I've never, you know, I know what it's like. She was about to go on stage in front of 30,000 people, you know, and so what if I was on crutches or whatever, you know? Maybe she thought like I did. Well, after the show, you know, I got to go on stage right now. Afterwards, maybe we'll hook up and have a talk or whatever. Yeah. And the woman from Pace said she would get the autograph and it never happened. Oh, I never got it.
But I didn't care because I really,
you know, even though that was my moment of connection with her, I really got the charge of somebody that I felt like I knew walking on stage.
Sure.
And I get that feeling myself from my job. And I had a few moments watching David Bowie come off before the encore on the Sirius Moonlight Tour. I was there. Yeah. I was dating Debbie Loeb at the time. It was Lisa Loeb, the singer's younger sister. And Lisa took Debbie and I, and we sat in Reunion Arena on the side of the stage. And David Bowie came off after the end of the set before the encore, and someone handed him a towel, someone handed him a lit cigarette, someone handed him a cocktail. And he stood there, and 17,000 people chanted, "Bowie, Bowie," and he mopped his forehead and smoked a cigarette and like kind of had a moment of zen.
Yeah.
And then he went back out. And something about those moments, her walking on stage and him going back out for the encore.
Sure.
It's like this really solitary moment that sort of emphasizes the grandiosity of the moment that's about to come.
Yeah.
And I loved that. And I thought that's a job I could do.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's great. God. Okay. David Bowie, Joan Jett. Good luck with number three, because those are two amazing stories. What if you're like Hootie?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
I've gotten to hang out with those guys. They're quite
I'm
nice.
I'm sure they're great. I'm sure they're great. I don't mean that in a disparaging way, other than that is a contemporary of yours.
Then and who cares?
There's nothing about it that seems like
glamorous.
Oh, yeah. Like paint your way. Like, to, you know. Good luck. Good luck. I don't see that happening.
You know what? I'll go the opposite direction. There's a young singer from Australia named Courtney Barnett.
You spoke about her earlier.
Yeah, everybody's obsessed with her. And I think she's just fantastic. And she seems like she'd be super fun to hang out with.
Great.
Don't think necessarily that I will. Well, who knows? Whatever.
Who knows? No, but I like this. I like that we're putting it out there in this way. All of these. Okay. Next category will be three books that you can go into and they're real worlds. So you're not a character in the book. It's just a place you can go and people you can visit and just like hang out and be in that place.
There's a book by David Mitchell that was sort of his British version of Catcher in the Rye, sort of coming of age novel called Black Swan Green.
Okay,
that I really love Black Swan Green. And it's funny. It's about a kid in England who's, you know, going through adolescence and his parents are having a lot of problems, and he has a stammer and he feels like an outsider, and which those are the best coming of age novels.
Absolutely.
Nobody wants to read about a kid that's got it all shit together.
Got it all together. Yeah.
Okay. So Black Swan Green.
That's great.
I really love books. So many of the books that I read are what we would call genre fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of embarrassingly lowbrow.
Uh-huh.
But there's a series, oh, this is so lowbrow. And especially if you only know it because of the movie that was so inaccurately cast with Tom Cruise as the lead role. There's a series I'm embarrassed that I'm even saying this, but I'll say it anyway.
I don't have any. These guys know I spend a ton of time just rereading books I read when I was in fifth grade.
There you go.
And feeling like I get a huge lesson out of them and stuff. So, I won't be able to have a conversation with someone who's reading, like, War and Peace.
Sure.
Really? That's
funny. You reminded me. Last night, I was at a club, and I met a woman who just started writing for Veep, this really smart young writer named Alexis. And she was telling me that she just reread... she didn't just reread it, but in fourth grade, she read Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Yeah. And we were all laughing, like, yeah, fourth grade kids are not encouraged to read Judy Blume anymore.
Yeah.
There's, speaking of masturbation.
Bummer, yeah.
Yeah. And now that I think about it, I think when I get home, I might... push that agenda. Anyway,
do it.
So there's a series about this former military police guy who just kind of goes around and helps people out of jams, and his name is Jack Reacher.
Yeah,
and it's the Lee Child's Jack Reacher series, and I just there's something so amazing about it. I guess the final one, and this is also lowbrow, but it's weird and old enough to where I'm not as embarrassed. There's a writer, John Dixon Carr, who was a contemporary of Agatha Christie. In fact, she frequently cited him as her favorite author.
Yeah.
And he had his equivalent of like Hercule Poirot, who's her Agatha Christie's famous detective. His was this detective named Gideon Fell. And Gideon,
did PBS ever do anything with Gideon Fell?
I don't think so. Oh my God, they really should, because the stories are all there.
We're all always looking for. I mean, I feel like I've really cycled through like every single like Inspector Morse, Endeavor,
yeah,
Hercule Poirot. You know, just everything. Like even the really like super dorky ones, like not Murder She Wrote, but like the British version of that, which I somehow excuse for myself because I'm like, I mean, it is British. That's that's in and of itself highbrow, I think.
So I guess I really love that world, and maybe the second two, I think that the thing that they have in common are their worlds where there is a right and a wrong, and at the end of each book, the things that were so wrong will have been righted. You know, the murderer will have been outed, or Jack Reacher will have taken care of whoever did the bad thing.
Yeah.
And I really like that. The real world doesn't work like that, and it can be frustrating wishing it did.
Yep. But I think that's a great point.
But fiction offers that.
I think that's a great point. I think that's very much what, like, sociologically people sort of talk about when they talk about, like, you're smart enough to be intrigued by something horrific, like a murder.
Yeah.
Albeit fictionalized, but then there's a sense of justice and a sense of sort of like, thank God people are smart enough to like fix this or whatever. I mean, that's great. Okay, three places in the world that would be fun to have a vacation home.
Maui.
Great.
I'd be right next door to Willie Nelson.
Perfect.
We'd just be hanging out. Golly, you know what I really love? I've gotten to tour Japan a few times, and I really love the culture and the people over there.
Yeah.
I don't think I would want a vacation home in Tokyo, but maybe Osaka?
Mm-hmm. Great. Great, great, great. And then one more.
I miss Los Angeles. I'm going to go vacation home in... I don't think I can do Malibu, though, just because I think I'd always feel like a fish out of water.
Uh-huh.
But maybe... what's outside of Malibu? Like maybe Ventura?
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's
I spent
more.
My summers a week at a time in Ventura.
Nice.
Great. I spent 1 week of most of my summers in Ventura.
So we want Stance Socks or any other fashion people to give Janet free clothes.
Uh-huh.
And anybody that has a free house in Ventura, they want to give me...
Yeah.
I'll take it.
That'd be great, guys. Let's get on it. Okay, next category is, this is MASH. So all due respect to your beautiful wife, I do need alternate universe. Now, it can be short-term sexy times. It can be long-term alternate universe companion. Any person from any time, any age. Obviously, it's more fun for us if we know who they are. Sure. But it could be, you know, 30-year-old Meryl Streep. It could be, it could be anything from any place.
What was the line in Swingers? I'd like eggs in the Age of Enlightenment.
There you go.
Wow, she said I want breakfast anytime.
There you go.
Okay, so, golly. Oh, I like this one. can we throw Joan Jett in there?
Yes! That's good because you have like that gives you a double chance.
Ooh, nice.
Of being around her.
Oh my gosh. Boy, it's so hard to think. Oh, Françoise Hardy. She's a French chanteuse who came to prominence in the 60s. So I'll say 1968, Françoise Hardy.
Okay, great.
Although she's still...
smoking.
Gorgeous. Love it. My gosh.
Love it.
Finally... oh, you know, and I've actually met her one time, but I'm going to throw her in there just because she's been on my mind lately. I was listening to an audiobook where she was reading one of her brother's short stories, Amy Sedaris.
Great.
Love Amy Sedaris.
Great, great, great.
Love it, love it, love it. What a great combo of women. Fantastic. Okay, three. Let's go with three, like, versions of your life as directed by three film directors. Like, how do you want to see yourself? Like, if you could see, you know, not necessarily that it really is a movie, but, like, what would your actual life look like as director? Like, how interesting would from the lens of these three directors? Does that make sense?
Sure, of course, of course. I wish I was as much of a cinephile as my friend Richard Edwards that sings in Margot and the Nuclear So-and-Sos knows every director and everything.
It's okay if you don't. I mean, you can go with some classics. No, like, I feel like I would pick people that everyone knows who they are.
Sure. Is this idealized, like...
Yeah, I mean, or, it's like for just for the artistic visual of it alone, I would probably still pick Wes Anderson. Yeah. Just because I would like... I want my life to have the costumes and sets and quirkiness of those movies.
Well, now you said that. How can I pick Wes Anderson?
You can pick Wes Anderson because it's a smart choice.
Well, it's funny. You know, his movie Rushmore that he wrote with Owen. Yeah. Owen went to St. Mark's.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And Wes went to the equivalent school in Houston where we used to do arts festivals together and stuff. And that is a lot. I mean, it's sort of a sort of blown out version of the school that we went to.
Let's put him in there.
I'll put Wes
Anderson. I think you have more right to have him in there than I do. Wes Anderson, perfect.
Gosh, who else? It's funny. I don't really know that I haven't watched all his movies because they get too violent for me. But I think it would be fun, in the same way that I said Jack Reacher is one of my, the worlds I could live in. I think it would be fun to have crazy old Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because the person that I'm not, that I wish I was, kicks so much ass.
Absolutely. And still has a sense of humor and still, you know what I mean? Yeah, like, intelligent. Like, I think that's great. That's a great choice.
Sort of a moral compass. But,
yeah, you know. Great choice.
And then finally, God, I wish I knew all those fancy old French directors. I don't, but they're so beautiful. Those black and whites. Oh
yeah. I mean, like a Truffaut would be.
Yeah. Okay, that's totally what I'm thinking of. Is beautiful. Truffaut. Can we do something like that? That's really super artsy and beautiful. And
no, because
a bunch
so
of pigeons are flying
there.
Away and then they reveal behind them. The lovers
kissing.
Well, it's
like a built in longing to any of those movies that I think is so fabulous. Wonderful. Love it. Okay. Next one is you wake up tomorrow and you have downloaded sort of Matrix style three skills. Let's make them real world skills opposed to like, you know, time travel or whatever.
Superhero skills.
Yeah.
Oh God. It seems weird. I've always wanted to be, I mean, considering that what I do for a living is walk up in front of people and sing my songs, and I've never felt terribly confident and, I don't know, maybe that seems insane, but I wish that I felt the way that I think I act on stage.
Oh my God, that's the most adorable admission I've ever heard. But I really relate to that. I think a lot of people do. And it's almost harder in a way when you feel like you know you have that secret in some sense. Like, it's almost hard. Like, then if someone just straight ahead thought of you as somebody who wasn't confident, you know, who wasn't, like, overly confident. But there's something, because I feel the same way sometimes. Like, when I do improv or something, I think to myself, like, oh, I know that someone thinks I'm, which is maybe one of the reasons I like doing this podcast, is because it gives me the opportunity to strip all of that away.
Yeah.
Like, rather than wanting to have the front, I feel better somehow being like, look, this is honestly who I am, guys. However I might come off. Like, I'm still this person. I think that's very good for people to hear.
Yeah.
You know, and to not be. And some people really just for some reason have like a ton of confidence and just don't. They're just like, I know I'm fucking awesome all the time. And I don't know why I know that, but I do.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
I know. Great.
You know, something that I'm not good at that I really wish that I had the skill is. Financial acumen. Mm-hmm. Like, I wish I knew how to monetize what I do better. I knew how to take care of what money I do have better.
Yeah.
You know, and now the more, like, because I have these kids and the only way I know how to feed them is to go out on the road, which means I'm not with them. And I wish that I knew some maybe other way to make money or some way to make the money I have go further.
Yeah.
But God, I miss them so bad. And it's like, my choices are be home and like not know how to pay our bills and be freaking out, or be on the road and just be like on the phone with my kids going, I love you, I miss you.
Oh God. I feel like we got to find some way to get every one of your songs used in something. Isn't that, that's the only thing I can think of, because as it relates to what I do, is like, God, it just feels like if you could just get your songs used, then you'll just keep getting paid whether or not you're on the road.
Mailbox money.
Let's get into that mailbox money, guys. Let's dive into it. Everyone you know who is a music supervisor. That's great. Financial. Okay, and then the third, and then just the third one.
I wish I was better at exercising. I honestly, cause I wish I would. We talked about having ripped abs, and I don't think I'd really want ripped abs per se. But I do. I find that I'm too lazy to get the kind of body I wish I had.
But you have a great body, but also like it's extremely. Doing a show is not exercising.
There are a lot of calories burned. That's true.
Yeah.
But I have friends that'll wake up and go run 5 miles, and I wish that I was more like that. And I've
that's
gotten
a habit forming thing too, though, because I was like that for a long time, and then I started doing it, and I created the habit of doing it. And then like anything else, if you're a person who likes consistency in a life you have that is fairly inconsistent, which is what I have, then those habits become really important because they kind of ground you. And so I think I got lucky, because now bicycling for me is that. And it's not so, I was thinking about that last night, because I was tired and it was sunny and I was riding, and I had started earlier than I usually like to, which is I like to be in the sunset. I don't like riding. Nice. Like, this is a nightmare day for me. A nightmare. People are like, what a beautiful day. And I'm like, it's a nightmare. There's no clouds. It's like 80
Your
degrees.
Fair skin is
I
just
don't want
get...
it. I will wait until the sun is going down. But I was thinking as I was like huffing up this hill, like, I'm not really enjoying this, but I am enjoying that I'm doing it. Do you know what I mean? It's like conceptually, I appreciate that I'm doing this, and I will feel great once I'm back home, and I'll have the adrenaline and all that kind of stuff and the endorphins. And those are things that sort of replace the idleness of like, ugh, but I could, you know, I don't want to be like panting and tired right now.
Yeah.
There's something about, but like knowing the consistency of it has become as important. So like in terms of habit forming, that's one thing you could do. But for me, it won't ever be like, and I got on the treadmill again.
Yeah.
That won't create that same satisfaction.
Well, all three of these things are things I'm actively working on, you know,
well,
trying to own myself and trying to be better about money and trying to, you know, I think they're all things, you know,
they're achievable.
Like, you said, it's not like time travel.
Right.
It's not something I can't do. And my daughter, whenever she's younger, she's 9, and she goes, Dad, I wish you were here right now. Have you figured out how to do, it's not time travel.
Like teleportation.
Teleportation.
Yeah. Get here right now.
Yeah. Have you figured out how to make a teleportation device? I'm like, no, I thought you were working on that. So our big joke is teleportation technology is what we're actively working on every
day. Well, what about that? Let's do the next category. I'm going to do the last two will be related to those two things.
Okay.
One category will be you can time travel to anywhere and in sort of a safe bubble. You can kind of observe and interact, but like you're not going to, you know, get influenza,
sure.
Which, by the way, is just the flu, everyone. And then so the funny. Other one is three places and activities that it would be fun to be able to teleport to with your kids.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
So let's do teleportation to someplace with your kids. Place and activity. Anywhere in the world or off world.
Sure. Oh, my gosh. Golly. I would love to take my kids to Japan. And obviously the traveling would be prohibitive at this point.
Yeah, so not in this case.
But I'd love to, like Mount Fuji.
Yeah.
The biggest show I ever performed was the Fuji Rock Festival at the base of Mount Fuji.
How fun.
500,000 people stretched
Holy
out in front of the stage.
Shit.
And I was on right before the Pretenders, and it was such a beautiful day. And I wish I could take them. I wouldn't want to go to that festival because crowds like that freak me out.
Me too.
But it's so beautiful there.
Yeah.
I'd like to take them.
Great. Love it.
Mount Fuji.
Okay, Mount Fuji. Two more.
I guess I would take my kids also to Maui if we could teleport.
Great.
Because I'd like them to see where, you know, their mom and I got married, and it's like the most beautiful sort of paradise place we've found.
Yeah.
And then finally, I think it would be really cool to take them someplace where they could never go. Like, honestly, I would love to take them. My brother got to go there when he was young, and my mom, and I couldn't go because I was fourth grade and it was my illness. The Middle East.
Yeah.
It's so sad. Like, I don't know if in our lifetimes we'll ever really be able to travel through the Middle East. And I'd love for them to see that.
It's great.
I'd love to see it. I've never gotten to see it.
Yeah. Great choice. Okay. And then our final category is you get to time travel in a safe bubble.
Eggs in the Age
to
of Enlightenment.
Anywhere, anytime.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I guess I would love to see Shakespeare's plays.
Oh, great one. Great one.
That's,
me too.
That's cheesy. But that was.
No, but it's. There's, I think as like I've gotten older, I've gotten so much more comfortable. I think I've said this before recently, but I've gotten so much more comfortable about being like, guess what? Yeah, there's a reason that we all still love William Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Like, it's great. The plays are great. Yeah. There's no, like, you don't have to find some obscure thing that, you know, isn't as good because less people appreciate it.
Exactly.
Like, they're great. The Beatles were great. Let's all just, like, get over it, everybody.
Exactly.
It's okay. It's okay that there are people, that there are hugely influential classics. And I think that's a great choice.
In my all English.
Because there's still so much mystery surrounding, like, there's so much controversy still with, you know, people about who
in my
was
dream, I'd be like in the, his box, like sitting next to him. And I'd be like, yeah. Are you actually William Shakespeare?
Yeah. And to see him, like, be like, oh, I'd rather have them say this. Like, to see it live and a living, breathing thing where he's like, I'm going to have them change that line to something different tomorrow.
Yeah.
It'd be amazing.
I guess I would love to go to the late 60s, the heyday of rock and roll.
Great.
Because it's something I threw my hat into this ring with rock and roll when it was one thing and now it's something so completely different.
Mm.
You know, and it was a bit of a bait and switch. You know, I don't think I would do anything. I wouldn't change anything if I could go back, but I would kind of like to see, like, hey, when you were allowed to be a golden god, you know, when rock and roll had all the mystique and all the supernatural sort of qualities.
Oh, God, that's great. That's absolutely great. Perfect. Late 60s, and then what's your final one?
I don't know. You know what I'd love to do? I'd love to go way, 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 way back to, like, just see, like, before any, I mean, not even technology, but before any, like, you know, when things were just really, I don't know about caveman, but when it was villages.
Yeah.
And when somebody who was, you know, Marshall McLuhan wrote that book, The Medium is the Massage. And one of his predictions in the 60s was that we'd live in a global village. And he emphasized that there was a time when each village had its own best singer-songwriter person or whatever. You know, each village had, you know, it was self-contained and you could be the best in your village and that was great.
Yeah.
I'd kind of like to go back to that and see a time when it was smaller, when the world was so much smaller.
I love that. Villages. I guess that's all. I was going to put village people, but I'm really for sure not going to do that. Okay. This is the part where I find out what your number is going to be that helps me with the process of elimination. So tell me when to stop.
Stop.
Okay. I'm going to do a little countdown. I'm going to pause this. Guys, I want to reassure you, we're 160 episodes deep. Plus, if you don't know by now that it will seem as no time has passed to you, you need to revisit some old episodes. All right, listen, a lot of good stuff has come from this MASH game, and I want to reassure you that your 100% guaranteed MASH future is a delight. Number one, I want to congratulate you on your apartment in Osaka.
Ah, cool.
I think that sounds divine as a fellow fan of the Japanese culture and Japan itself. I want to also congratulate you on the trip to the very safe teleport with your kids trip to the Middle East, which probably is maybe the most unlikely in a way. So good on you. And also, like, I'm glad we got rid of Mount Fuji because, you know, you have your apartment in Osaka. That's probably eventually going to happen
redundant.
Anyway.
It would be redundant, yeah.
So you were able to clear more stuff that way. If you want to travel into a totally other world that isn't any of those, I welcome you to walk into the world of Gideon Fell.
Oh, cool.
Pretty great. Nice. I got to get into those books, stat. Or travel back in time and check out when things were simpler. And there were village people everywhere.
Yeah.
So good on you for that. I want to reassure you and congratulate you on your performance with David Bowie.
God, what if it happened? What if it actually happened because of you, Jane Varney?
I'm holding up this MASH pad very significantly as if I'm quietly guaranteeing something I have no business guaranteeing.
You know, he owns a home not far from where I live. He owns a mountain not far from where I live.
I think that anything is... I really think that if a person is alive, anything is possible.
There you go.
Emma Thompson, I'm talking to you.
And you know what? One of the reasons that you need not worry is that you have all the confidence in the world. So you know it's on its way.
All right.
I've just given you that gift. I guess it was mine to give, turns out. I also am very excited to see your life in the world of Wes Anderson.
Interesting. Nice.
Really, really good job. Which you also share with your beautiful alternate universe companion, Françoise Hardy.
Oh, yeah. I think Wes Anderson probably is a fan of Françoise Hardy.
I think I would agree. I mean, I see you guys cutting a very nice jib, indeed, in some really, really fantastic clothes in a wonderful world. That is your MASH future.
I love it.
My dear friend.
Has anybody else ever gotten Wes Anderson before?
I don't think so.
Nice.
I don't think it's not a question I come up with that often. Uh-huh. So I feel like I've done it a handful of times and I don't think Wes Anderson has ever been achieved.
I like it.
Yeah, no, it's a good, it's a coup.
Yes.
It's a real coup. Rhett, what would you like to tell people? I will say that you just had an album come out fairly recently that is wonderful.
Thank you.
So why don't you tell the nice folks listening about that?
I had a solo record come out on ATO Records called The Traveler that I made with a band from Portland, Oregon called Black Prairie that features a lot of members of the Decemberists and then a couple others. And yeah, I'm really happy with it. And Peter Buck from REM plays on there too a bunch, which was a dream come true.
Absolutely.
My little 14-year-old self is weeping.
Those are the best. Yeah. Those moments where you're like, I can still connect with the kid who's like, nuh-uh.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that's great.
You're on Twitter. Pimping. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm really active on Instagram mostly.
Perfect.
And some on Twitter.
So are they both Rhett Miller?
Just Rhett Miller.
Perfect.
I got my own, which was sort of annoying. I'm like, I thought I was famous enough to not be able to get my own name, but I guess I was in pretty early on both of those.
I wish that I could even say I had that complaint. I was not concerned in any way that someone would already have my, although that I say it, I almost think that Instagram, there might be an at Janet Varney because I didn't pick that.
That's right.
Interesting. I got to do some research.
We will
and some
find
killing.
Her. Yeah.
Awesome. This was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thanks, buddy. Janet.
Guys, check out all that stuff. You need to get into Old 97s and Rhett's solo stuff if you aren't already. I feel certain many of you are. But and we'll talk to you next time on the podcast. Oh, I almost forgot. Oh, my God. I almost forgot with a musician whom I asked last year, like, I know you're super busy and always on the road, but if you want to cover this song for me and like record it in a recording studio for me for no reason other than that it would please me, please do so. You still have the opportunity to do that. But right now I have a thing I do with every boy of summer, which is to put them entirely on the spot and make them sing part of it on Henley's Boys of Summer. And I only very recently had a listener say, you know what would be helpful, Janet, is if you printed out the lyrics. I've never done that until just today. And every person leading up to this, if they don't know, I have to like feed them the words or just sing it for them. Not today.
You know what's so funny? Henley lives in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
And we have friends in common, and I've interacted with him a little bit.
So you're the first person that I know who has actually interacted with Don Henley.
Well, and then back when this song came out, he made a video in Dallas of the song.
I remember that video very well.
Sure. And in the video, there's a couple, like a young couple that's frolicking amidst tall grass.
Yeah.
The girl is Ricky Haas, who I dated.
That's so crazy.
Within a year of that video.
Oh, wow. That is fucking nuts.
It is.
Oh, my God. So you can just pick like a stanza or the chorus or whatever you want and just like give it an off the cuff, if you don't mind.
Sure.
No pressure.
I can see you. Your brown skin is shining in the sun. I see you walking real slow and you're smiling at everyone. I can tell you my love for you will still be strong after the boys of summer have gone.
As always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.